Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast.
Showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change with Phoebe Scott,
Alex Miller,
Lottie Flashkus,
and Guy Wilkinson.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the IB Green Minds podcast. I'm Lottie, your host for this episode, and joining me today is Maria Duval, Director of Climate and Energy at Client Earth. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Lottie.
So to get started, what is Client Earth and what do you do as Director of Climate and Energy?
Well, Client Earth is an environmental legal organization that was created in London back in 2007. And because it's fundamentally an organization of lawyers fighting for the planet and the people, we are quite unique in the sense that we are not first and foremost a campaigning organization, but we are an organization using all of the tools and facets of the law to fight for the environment. And that goes from helping to draft ambitious laws to all the way to litigation when we feel that a law has been breached and that we need to bring that to the attention of the courts. We work on all of the facets of protecting the environment. I happen to work in climate change, but I have wonderful colleagues who work to protect the oceans, who work on fisheries and forests. I also have colleagues who work in Asia, and I'll talk about that a little bit more, in the United States, across Europe. But we are also very lucky to have an incredible network of partners that enable us to take action in approximately 60 countries around the world. So while we are still a growing organization, even though we now have more than 170 lawyers, we are able to have outreach and impact in many countries around the globe where the fight against climate change and against environmental degradation is needed. What do I do at Client Earth? In a way, I have two hats. One is that I head our climate team, and the other is that I oversee a certain number of other portfolios across the organization because I try to ensure that we have alignment across all of our portfolios. Now, when it comes to the climate team, our climate team essentially is working to achieve three objectives. One is to hold governments accountable for their duties and commitments under international and national law. The second is to hold corporations accountable for their environmental externalities and their own duties. And we'll be talking a little bit more about that today. And finally, our climate finance colleagues are working very hard to divert financial flows away from fossil fuel projects, infrastructures, and activities around the world. And so that really means tackling what the big insurance companies, the pension funds, and the banks, as well as public financial institutions, are funding, and to try to ensure that they no longer fund a new coal-fired power plant, for instance, or a gas plant, but redirect that money into renewable energy and renewable activities. I also said that I work to align our other portfolios together. So I work with my colleagues in Asia. We have an office in China that has been working for several years to train judges in China, as well as work on what we call greening the Belt and Road Initiative. And for those who don't know, the Belt and Road Initiative is a Chinese government-led initiative to invest in around 55 countries around the world, principally in infrastructure. And we're working very hard with the Chinese government to green that infrastructure, because obviously if China commits to net zero for its own country by 2060, but does not green its overseas investments, then we're fighting a losing battle. So we're working in China. We are very, very soon going to start working in Southeast Asia. We're opening an office in Singapore in about a matter of weeks, literally. And that means that we will start to work on climate and energy issues across several jurisdictions that go from Pakistan and Bangladesh in West Asia to South Korea and Japan in East Asia. So as you can imagine, some very different jurisdictions in terms of the law, but also very different economic and financial structures. And we will be there as well, using a lot of the tools that we have used in Europe in order to advance change on climate and energy in Southeast Asia. We are also starting to work in the United States. We're very encouraged to see, obviously, a lot of change coming from the US since President Joe Biden was instated in January of this year, but there's still a lot to do in the US, despite change at the federal level and the fact that the United States have re-entered the Paris Agreement. So we see the United States as a key market and jurisdiction for us to continue to effect change, not only because of the amount of emissions that come from the United States, but also the power of the financial institutions in the United States that also are investing, obviously, in countries around the world. And they can choose either to invest in clean or in so-called dirty energy. I'm also working with our colleagues in what we call our fossil fuel infrastructure team. And we'll have a chance to talk about them a little bit more today, because they are really the ones who've been fighting against coal-fired power plants in Europe, and successfully so. And we are also going to bring the fight more and more to against the gas industry, which is something that is changing more and more as we see coal decrease in importance in Europe. We're seeing gas increase in importance as part of the transition. And finally, I'm working with our colleagues in the energy markets and state aid team. They are working to make energy markets more competitive across Europe, as well as encourage the European Commission not to allow state aid for projects across the European Union that are in fact against the European Union's own climate and energy targets. And last but not least, I oversee our agriculture work in Europe. You may know that the largest part of the European Union's budget actually goes to what is called the Common Agricultural Policy. And that's essentially paying farmers for a certain number of practices on their own farms and ways of producing. And agriculture is a source of emissions, very importantly so. And I think a lot of people don't realize the amount of emissions. Globally, it's roughly 15%, although it depends whether you count transport as well as part of the emissions coming from agriculture. But agriculture is a particularly nauseous sector when it comes to climate and energy and the environment. So we are also working very hard to change the common agricultural policy at the European level. So that's sort of who Client Earth is and what I do there.
Thank you very much for giving that overview. And we're going to spend most of this podcast talking, of course, about Client Earth's work. But before we do, it would be great to talk to you about your career up to this point. So could you tell us a little bit about the beginning of your career and what sparked your interest in using the law to protect the environment?
Sure. My career, and I think my entry into the law, was really inspired by the fact that when I was still a student, I wrote my master's dissertation on the civil war in Angola that you may know raged for about 30 years and tore the country apart. And that civil war was really about natural resources. It was about diamonds and oil. And each side sort of had possession of one of those resources, and that's how they funded and fueled the conflict. And that really sparked my interest in governance and rule of law issues. So I went on to become a lawyer on the basis of that. And I practiced human rights in public and private international law for about 10 years. I, during that time, became increasingly, I think it's right to say, concerned about the plight of migrants and how environmental change and degradation was pushing people. Not only, you know, we often hear about stories about migration coming from conflict and persecution, but more and more the trends that we've been seeing over the last few years is that a lot of migration is in fact caused by environmental degradation, desertification being one, for instance. In Africa, that's increasingly the reason why farmers no longer can work on their land and produce food for their families and have to move. And that was the beginning of my journey into using the law to protect the environment. That journey, I have to say, did take me via New Zealand and via a really interesting position I had there, not working at all as a lawyer, but in fact, as an economic advisor to the government. I was lucky enough to move to New Zealand in 2017, just as Jacinda Ardern, who's now prime minister for the second term, was being elected for her first term. And she was elected with a supportive coalition government that included the Greens. And the Greens obviously had a very ambitious climate and environmental agenda. And therefore the government was looking for advisors on how to make that agenda possible, not only from a legal standpoint, but also just economically what that would cost the economy over the next 20 to 30 years to actually fund that transition to get to net zero by 2050. So that's what I was able to do in the New Zealand government. And I can talk a little bit more about that. But it was really that journey that brought me to Client Earth. I mean, I had been looking at Client Earth for years and really, really admired their work because they had started back in 2010 suing the British government for clean air pollution and its lack of fulfillment of its of the government's obligation on clean air duties and commitments. And so when the opportunity to come and work on climate change for Client Earth came, I thought, well, this is absolutely the most incredible opportunity because it enables me to marry the policy experience that I've had working for government with the legal experience of practicing as a lawyer for several years. I think it's probably worth me reflecting on the type of work that I did when I was in New Zealand and what was the most powerful part of that work. I think when I look back now that it's been almost a year since I left, I mean, I think the New Zealand government at the end now of 2019 passed the Zero Carbon Act, which is very much, by the way, modeled on the UK's Climate Change Act 2008. And that was an incredible milestone moment for New Zealand as a country, but also I think it's an interesting place because even though it's a small country, it has quite an important place on the world stage. And one of the things that I think we were really proud to achieve was the fact that methane emissions are included in the Zero Carbon Act. And the reason that's relevant is because New Zealand's economy is based essentially on two sectors, travel and tourism, as well as agriculture. And so 49% of their emissions actually come from the agricultural sector, which makes it a bit of a unique outlier in terms of rich OECD countries in the terms of its structure of its economy, as well as the structure of its emissions. So getting broad political consensus to add methane emissions to the Zero Carbon Act was a huge political win, as well as a policy win, I think, in terms of bringing ministers together and then obviously parliament when they voted for the act. The Zero Carbon Act, though, can't be taken in isolation because in itself, it sets some targets for 2050, which is incredibly important. But if you don't have milestones to get there, then you're going to wake up in 2049 and think, how on earth are we now going to actually reduce these emissions? It's a little bit more complex than that, but I think it's important to make that point because it's a framework piece of legislation and a lot needs to happen to make it possible. And obviously one of the things that's incredibly important to make that happen, in my view, and I think in the view of a lot of economists, is to have either a carbon price through a tax or through a cap and trade system. So another piece of the work that we did alongside drafting the Zero Carbon Act and advising ministers on it was reforming the emissions trading scheme system, which has been in place in New Zealand for a while, but it's fair to say had not been functioning because emissions have continued to rise over that period. We also did some very interesting work on, I guess, raising the awareness of ministers on the climate implications of their policy decisions. When we started working on this, when ministers were considering a cabinet paper in cabinet, they never considered what the climate implications of a policy decision might be. So for instance, to build a new highway, what over time would the emissions projections of that highway mean in terms of the carbon budget of the country? That's not something that was being viewed in the decision-making process before cabinet in New Zealand. And what we designed at the Treasury was a climate implications of policy assessment tool that integrated those projections into cabinet papers in order to not to bind, I have to say, we didn't get that far, but to inform decision makers about the impacts of their decisions in terms of long-term projections for emissions. And we're hoping that over time, maybe one day that will become a binding assessment and will really constrain ministers when they're making those decisions. And finally, the last thing I would point out, because there's a lot of conversation around this more broadly across the environmental sector, but I think the pandemic has also brought this to the fore, is, as you know, GDP has for a long time been considered the main metric of success for countries. And what New Zealand has tried to start doing is not only to consider GDP as a measure of success, but taking a much broader view as to what well-being is. And so back in 2018, we helped the Minister of Finance pass the world's first well-being budget, where instead of looking at a pure cost-benefit analysis of what we were, you know, what different ministries were bringing in terms of new policies, we tried to adopt a broader view of how that would contribute to the well-being of New Zealanders over time. Now, that's a work in progress, but I think it's something that we all felt immensely proud to be a part of.
Even within on the program I'm on at Imperial, we have a lot of discussions about GDP and its shortcomings. So that's really exciting work. So let's turn now to Client Earth and how Client Earth holds corporations accountable. So could you describe the Client Earth versus Anea case? What other examples of successes has Client Earth had with coal power plants?
Absolutely. I think, though, if you are comfortable with this, I might take one step back, because it may surprise people that one would use the types of tools that we used in the Anea case. A few years ago, climate change was really seen only as an environmental issue. And back in 2015, the then governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, made probably what can be considered a groundbreaking speech, where he linked climate change to the stability of the financial system. He essentially said, if we don't fix the issue of climate change, we will see economic recessions and shocks to our financial stability that we have never seen before. And that really created the realization, I think, across the world, because obviously the position held by the governor of the Bank of England is one that's incredibly influential, that climate change needs to be fixed not only because it's an environmental issue, but also because it's an economic and financial issue that is systemic. So if obviously nowadays, because our economies are so interlinked, if one economy crashes, then so does the rest of the financial system, especially if we're talking about large economies such as the United States or as the European Union. And so that also translates to companies and to how they are run, because directors, and this is now I'll get on to the law a bit more without becoming too technical, but directors essentially of a company owe a duty to the company to act in its best interests. And so what that means is that as the director of a company, you need to look over time at the risks that the company is taking and what kind of impact those risks can have on the company's financial performance over time for itself as well as for its shareholders. And once it has been established that climate change is an essential material risk, as a director, you cannot ignore that risk when you're making important business decisions for the company. And this is where I get to the story of Ostrołęka and Enea. So Ostrołęka was a project in Poland that was going to become a coal-fired plant. And essentially, there had already been discussions in the investment world about whether this new coal-fired power plant would essentially be a savvy investment or a stranded asset, and a stranded asset simply means that it gets built, but it really never gets used. And essentially it's a loss maker either from the very beginning or it's projected to be a loss maker very soon after the money has been invested into it. And so from that point of view, what we challenged once the decision had been made at the board level to go ahead with the investment was that the directors who put this investment forward and recommended to the board that it vote for it were breaching their duties to the company. So the duties that we call fiduciary duties, which are those duties essentially to act in the best interest of the company. And so for the very first time, an environmental and climate case was really brought on financial materiality grounds, which was something quite unique and very different compared to what had been done before. And we won that case. And what's very interesting as well is that this very same day that the court agreed with us, the share price of the company actually went up, which was very interesting in terms of the market's interpretation about whether or not this investment was the one to make in Poland at the time. And that's even more interesting, I'd say, because Poland is obviously, in terms of its own policy on climate and energy, is not at the forefront of the transition in Europe. But it means that even in Poland, there's a realization by investors that the transition means that these kinds of investments are no longer viable, and that directors of companies and companies themselves and their boards should no longer be making these types of investments in coal. So I think that was for us a huge win, especially in a country like Poland. And we have had some other wins, which I can talk about. I thought I'd talk about two different ones on the coal fight in Europe. One is in Greece. We decided to bring a certain number of challenges with local partners against coal plants in Greece. And we were so successful in those challenges that the Greek government decided to bring forward its phase out of coal to 2028. So by using the law and by using litigation under against those individual plants, we were able to really achieve a shift in policymaking by the Greek government. So we see this as incredibly significant. The other success, I think it's fair to say, that we've had on coal is also in Poland. We decided in 2019 to challenge what is Europe's largest greenhouse gas emitter, which is a power plant called Bełchatów in Poland. And essentially it emits roughly the equivalent of New Zealand's greenhouse gas emissions year on year. So not only is it an incredibly damaging for the environment and for people who live around it, as you can imagine, for air pollution and quality issues, it also happens to be, we see again, a financial threat to continue to pour money into this asset. So again, thinking about the financial viability of the plant. And so we decided to challenge the plant. And the court has not rendered a decision in the sense that it has not asked for a closure of the plant, but it ordered both parties, the claimant and the defendant, to go and start negotiations last year as to how we could agree on an earlier close down of the plant. And this is absolutely an unseen decision by the Polish courts. So we were incredibly proud to achieve that at the end of 2020, and the negotiations are ongoing, and it's not something that we are able to discuss. But those are just a few of the other examples of some of our wins when it comes to fighting what remains of coal in Europe.
And now, to take a slightly different aspect of energy companies, could you tell us a bit about Client Earth's case against BP? What precedent does it set in terms of greenwashing?
So Client Earth's case against BP, I think, is an incredibly important precedent from a legal standpoint, I think as well, it's fair to say, as from a communications and a campaign standpoint, because while a lot of our cases are successful in the courts, they may not always reach the consumer in terms of understanding how a company's behavior may affect them. When you start talking about advertising and misleading advertising, I think you immediately strike a different chord with consumers and citizens at large. And so with the BP case, we were very happy to see the tremendous media coverage that we got on that, as well as the actual precedent that it set. So what we did is we did something that hadn't really been done yet. We decided to use not a court, but a different type of forum. So we brought a complaint before what is called the UK's national contact point. And the UK, because British Petroleum is a UK headquartered company. And the national contact point is a system whereby, under what is called the OECD's multinational guidelines on enterprises, you can, if you consider that an enterprise has behaved badly, you can bring a complaint against the contact point, the national contact point in which that company is based. So here it was the UK. And so we decided to use something novel to see exactly what we could use and how powerful a complaint to the OECD would be. What was really interesting in that case is that a matter of weeks after we actually launched the case and brought the complaint before the national contact point, British Petroleum decided to withdraw the advertising campaign and also made a pledge to end all corporate reputation advertising. And within a matter of months, it also actually, and this is not linked directly to our case, but it decided to adopt 2050 targets of its own as a company. So for us, this set a precedent on a number of grounds, but I think importantly, the OECD and using an alternative dispute resolution mechanism was incredibly powerful. Also because of the number of member states that the OECD has, which means that you could potentially, within a company that has a more complex set of structures, you could potentially bring a claim against using different national contact points in different countries of the OECD. But I think especially the fact that this is something that consumers can relate to is incredibly important. And this is an obvious greenwashing complaint when it comes to fossil fuel companies. I should say there are a lot more that need to be brought, and other companies and NGOs are bringing greenwashing complaints against fossil fuel companies, because there's a lot more to do. I should say there are a lot of other tools that can be used from a legal standpoint to do this, not only the OECD's guidelines. There are a number of local national laws across jurisdictions that protect consumers. One of them could be the way that advertising is done in a particular jurisdiction. So France has just decided to make a change to its legislation in terms of reining in what advertisers can do when it comes to fossil fuel advertising. In the Netherlands, for instance, as well, the Competition Authority of the Netherlands has just brought out new guidelines on greenwashing. So this is also taking pace and gaining pace, which is incredibly encouraging. And I think that our complaint also opens the door to complaints against different types of companies, not only fossil fuel companies, but companies that produce plastics, which obviously in a large part are the fossil fuel companies because it's through them that the plastic industry is thriving. But I think we see that as a way to use the same methodology to bring claims against companies that are using, you know, illegal logging as a basis for their products or plastics or are making other kinds of spurious environmental claims. I think that there's the potential to use a lot of different laws across Europe and across the world to bring more claims on greenwashing against companies. So I think that for us, that really opened a new door for the work, not only in the climate team, but at Client Earth in general.
And moving now to think about holding governments accountable. In 2019, Client Earth took the UK government to court over the decision to give planning permission for what would have been Europe's largest gas power plant. Could you explain a bit about this case and why, despite the approval being upheld at the time, Client Earth still had an impact here?
Well, we were very happy to see just a few weeks ago that Drax has essentially decided to cancel the whole plan. Now, for us, that was really a moment of virtually, because we can't see each other in the office, of cracking open the bottles of champagne. Because one of the things that you can do when you bring a case, even if you don't win on every point of the law, is that you create delay. And in a case like the Drax case, even calling into question, not only at the planning stage, because we challenged the planning permission stage, and then once the planning permission had been given, we then started a case against the British government. We delayed the building of the plant in essence. And that in of itself has been incredibly powerful because it so happens that at the moment things are changing so quickly and the pandemic has made this even worse, that the fact during this window when the case was actually being considered first by the High Court and the Court of Appeal, there was obviously further thinking going on at the level of the Drax board, which made them also realize that this investment was, again, a stranded asset in the making. And so they've decided to pull their plans for that. On the law, though, I would also say that while the government's decision was upheld, we received from the Court of Appeal incredibly useful guidance and clarification on how these decisions should be made and how the government should take climate change impacts into account when it authorizes such a planning permission decision. So there was a very, very helpful clarification of the law through the process of bringing the case. And that's also for us as lawyers, an incredibly important thing for us to get out of a court decision is that kind of clarification, because it then calls into question any subsequent planning decisions that will be made by the government, because now it sets that precedent on what types of considerations the government needs to include in its decision-making process. So we're absolutely, I have to say, thrilled with the Drax decision.
So we've talked a lot about kind of quite varied topics about financial viability, advertising and planning. But let's also talk a bit about human rights, because Client Earth has brought a complaint against the Australian government. Could you elaborate a bit about this and what's been happening?
Of course. Yes. So I think we've talked a lot today about finance and corporate law and the fact that Client Earth, from that point of view, is quite a unique organization in the number of cases in which it's used those tools, which I don't think people often associate with an environmental legal organization. We, however, also use human rights arguments, both in national law and at the international level, in order to bring cases against governments. And our Torres Strait case is emblematic of the types of cases that can be brought. So we brought a complaint on behalf of inhabitants of the Torres Strait Islands that are situated north of Australia, and they are low-lying Pacific islands where islanders there are already really seeing some of the most extreme impacts of climate change, which are affecting their daily lives. And they wanted to bring a claim against the Australian government for failure. As we know, the Australian government is a particularly bad offender when it comes to climate change policy. They wanted to bring a claim against the government, alleging that the fact that it has not been acting to mitigate climate change or to help inhabitants adapt to climate change means that the government is essentially violating their human rights. And we thought that in order to have a real international resonance if we got a positive decision in our favor, bringing the case before the United Nations Human Rights Council would be an incredibly effective and powerful tool. So that's exactly what we did. We have a case pending before the Human Rights Council, and we are really hoping to get a positive decision over the next few months, which I think would send a very powerful political message to the Australian government. And in fact, I should say, after we filed our claim, the Australian government decided to allocate 25 million Australian dollars to building seawalls and other types of flood defenses in the Torres Strait, which was quite an interesting indication and a political response from the government. By no means adequate, by the way, but it does mean that even just the fact of filing the claim was noticed by the government, which we see as a positive sign. But also, were we to get, as we hope, a positive decision, I think this will also mark a precedent in terms of vulnerable people and how they are affected by climate change, because the Torres Strait Islands are very small islands. They're quite isolated. It's a small group of people. But these are sometimes the people who will be the most affected by climate change. And we want to make sure at Client Earth that their voices are heard. And we think that if the Human Rights Council makes a decision in their favor, that will also send a message to other groups across the world that they can bring similar claims and actually win on similar claims. And we are also, I should add, when it comes to human rights, that we are also working with a local partner in Africa, in a country working on a case against an African state for the same kind of violations of human rights because of inadequate responses to what to climate change impacts in that particular country. And these are also communities who are, whose voices are not often heard. And so we feel very proud to be able to use our voice to make those voices heard more loudly in the courts.
So in addition to this work that we've discussed so far, Client Earth has recently released a report called Accountability Emergency Review. I'm wondering why you decided to investigate this briefly, the methodology and what the key findings and implications of the report were.
Yes, so this report really was the culmination of several months of work. So when you ask about the methodology, I mean, this was literally a manual review of the annual reports of 250 companies listed on the London Stock Exchange. So a human endeavor of sorts, I think, in terms of looking through these annual reports. The reason we thought it was important is because companies in the UK that are based or listed in the UK have a certain number of disclosure obligations. And we were asking ourselves, well, do these disclosure obligations, do they get translated in what these annual reports say about these companies' risks and what risks they have and which ones they are mitigating? And while the report concludes that we have seen some improvement when it comes to annual reports, I think it's fair to say that overall, we were disappointed in the performance of companies themselves in terms of what is actually in the annual reports, in terms of information, as well as the quality of the information that we can find in annual reports. But we were also worried and disappointed to see that the auditors who are then submitting reports on these companies in 90% of cases make no reference to climate change. And we see that as a true failure in the system, because for us, this is something that auditors should be picking up again as material risks for the companies that they audit. And they are clearly underperforming in their role. Finally, probably the other point to raise here is one about the regulators, because those who have to look at these annual reports and decide whether or not they are adequate are ultimately the financial and corporate regulators. And this, by the way, was a UK-specific report, but I'm sure that we would find a lot of similar findings if we ran the same kind of research in other member countries of the European Union, in Asia, or in the United States. So we also saw the report as quite important for us as a first step in terms of assessing the landscape and what more can be done. So I think that we also see a much more increased role for regulators to step up and look at annual reports and bring enforcement proceedings when those reports are inadequate.
Thank you very much for those insights. It's been wonderful to talk to you today. To wrap up the episode, I just have a couple more questions. So the first one is, if a listener is interested in working in environmental law or law that in some way pertains to the environment, what advice would you have for them?
I mean, I think I would say that working in the law is an incredibly powerful and stimulating experience. And I mean, the reason I'm here, the reason my wonderful colleagues are at Client Earth is because we are convinced that we can affect change. And that's either through, as I was saying at the beginning of the episode, regulatory complaints or litigation, but sometimes it's purely through advocacy. But as we've sort of touched on during the episode, you don't need to study environmental law, in fact, to become an environmental lawyer, because we've been talking today about using corporate tools, finance law, but we could also be talking about intellectual property or tax. There are a number of areas in the legal infrastructure and framework that you could use to benefit the environment and the planet. So I would say that if you're a listener who's interested in the law on the one hand and in the environment, keep an open mind, because actually there are a lot of things that you could be doing to change the world for it to be a better and more livable place. And those places are not necessarily where you might think they are. So I would say trying to do a lot of research, speaking to as many people as possible, but also continuing to practice and to do something that you're interested in, because we need people to be in this movement for the long run. So we really need people who enjoy their day-to-day work.
And if listeners take away one thing from this episode of the IB Green Minds podcast, what would you want it to be?
I think every day you can do something for the planet, right? It sounds very trite and obvious, but you can rethink your voting behavior. You can rethink your consumer and patterns and behaviors, the way you transport yourself, mobility systems. You don't necessarily need to work for an environmental NGO to change the way that our environment is being protected. And so I think that's what I would like to conclude on, because I think some people come and say to us, but what can I do? This is such an immense problem. It's almost too big to tackle. When in fact, that's not the case, because there are some very small changes that one can make. And there's also, you know, many ways nowadays to make your voice heard, whether it's protesting or whether it's writing to your MP, that can also achieve change in the environmental sector, because essentially we need governments to understand that it's not only 20% of the population that is interested in the environment, but it's 80 or 90%, and that this is one of the things that they will be held accountable for.
That's all from us. Thank you so much, Maria, for taking the time to appear on IB Green Minds and also for explaining the law in such a clear and accessible way for our listeners.
Well, thank you, Lottie, for inviting me. I was truly honoured.